Chapter 9. How big can we go? As Joe Biden prepared to take office, he could sense the fire in his party. The incoming president had long struggled to ignite real passion among his fellow Democrats. They had embraced him as a leader for pragmatic reasons, not because of his raw charisma or his visionary policy ideas. It was no sure thing that Biden would be able to command the energetic support of his party for executing an agenda in office. The events of early January changed things. Now, for the first time in a decade, Democrats had full control of the federal government, and they were determined to deliver monumental change to the country. The nation was in a state of crisis, still reeling from the January 6th attack and the ongoing scourge of the coronavirus. Days before the riot, the American death count from the pandemic had exceeded 350,000. To the Democrats, this looked like a moment for daring action, action that would redeem American democracy and deal a crushing repudiation to the far-right party that had done so much to degrade it. Tiny though their congressional majorities were, Biden and his party intended to move fast and do big things. It was not clear how long this moment of fire would last. In the Senate, Chuck Schumer was readying his caucus for a legislative blitz. There was a huge backlog of Democratic priorities that had languished in the last few rounds of pandemic relief negotiations, including the fate of enhanced unemployment insurance programs and the hundreds of billions of dollars the party wanted to spend on aid to state and local governments. In both chambers, senior Democratic legislators were hoping to use the emergency bill as a vehicle for larger economic reform, including raising the federal minimum wage to $15 per hour and creating a greatly expanded tax credit for people with children. Schumer knew it was highly unlikely that Republicans would go along with most of those policies. His party would likely have to enact a bill through the procedure known as reconciliation, a legislative tool that bypasses the Senate filibuster, with its 60-vote threshold to bring legislation up for a vote, and requires only 50 votes to pass so long as the contents of the bill in question concern spending and revenues. Going down that path would require that Schumer keep his own caucus entirely united. It would also require Democrats to submit their legislation to the review of the Senate parliamentarian, an obscure official who would adjudicate whether certain items were eligible for inclusion in a reconciliation bill. Pelosi had a minute majority to work with in the House, but Schumer had only a nominal majority in the Senate. With 50 votes on his side, he would have to keep every single Democrat in line so that Kamala Harris could break a tie in their favor as the newly inaugurated vice president. At 70, Schumer was the young man of the Democratic Party's leadership trifecta, a comparative adolescent next to the 80-year-old speaker and the 78-year-old president-elect. But he had spent a long time in public life, winning his first election to the New York State Assembly in 1974, just 2 years after Biden was elected to the Senate. In his decades-long climb to the most important job in the Senate, Schumer had acquired a reputation as a reasonably self-aware political opportunist, a publicity hound who chased big headlines and big donors, a campaign tactician rather than a policy visionary who spent far more time poring over polling data and advertisements in battleground states than the think tank studies and academic papers some of his colleagues favored. Biden himself was known to express wariness of Schumer. The two men had not clicked when Schumer arrived in the Senate in the late 1990s as a scrappy brawler fresh out of the House. Biden, already a Senate elder by then, had sized up Schumer as a man overly comfortable with the art of political spin, a person whose word he could not necessarily take to the bank. Schumer, in his eyes, had been a younger man in a hurry, and in some respects Biden still saw him that way as the Democratic leader entered his eighth decade. Even Senate Democrats who liked Schumer were still uncertain of his capabilities as a majority leader. Centrists feared that Schumer would be excessively sensitive to left-wing activists back home in New York, while progressives still worried about his long history of catering to Wall Street and other big-money interests. In an early meeting with Biden's advisors after the election, Schumer poked fun at one close presidential aide for his perceived ideological transformation over a decades-long career in Washington. Alluding to Ron Klain's emergence as a trusted ambassador to congressional progressives, Schumer joked, "I knew Ron before he was a big liberal." It was probably not lost on Schumer that Klain could have said the same about him. Yet Schumer's colleagues also knew him as more than the camera-chasing hype artist of much caricatured notoriety. He had shown real facility during the Trump years in managing the competing factions of an opposition party, regularly checking in with his caucus on their cell phone numbers he learned by heart and dialed from memory on the flip phone he refused to upgrade. He had also been an effective legislative negotiator and salesman in the past, helping drive major gun control legislation through the House in the 1990s. Now Schumer was in salesman mode again, goading his caucus to support the largest possible aid bill, all while preparing for an impeachment trial and confirming the Biden cabinet as quickly as they could. He enlisted the two unlikely heroes of the Georgia campaign, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, to help him make the case for going very, very big on relief aid, prodding them on a conference call to tell the other Democrats just how much help they had promised the voters of their state. They had promises to keep, and so did their party. Beyond the 49 other members of his caucus, there was a 50th target of Schumer's salesmanship, the incoming president. Joe Biden felt the same urgency as the congressional leaders about showing the country that help was on the way. He, too, was angry about the January 6 attack and the conduct of the Republican Party. But Biden had also talked throughout his campaign about bipartisanship and reaching across the aisle, and he still seemed to believe that he might be able to maneuver McConnell into being something less than a full-on obstructionist. To Schumer, that was a dangerous way to think, and he told Biden as much. "McConnell," he told the president-elect, "will try to thwart you in any way possible." "He won't always act like it," Schumer acknowledged, "but if you give him the opportunity to block your agenda, then block it he will." As Biden prepared to take office, he was still not quite sure how he wanted to approach the Congress and how he should balance his promise to enact a bold progressive agenda with his aspiration to unite the country and reach across the aisle. He had insisted from the start of the campaign that he believed it would be possible to work with Republicans for the good of the American people, and he had meant it. Biden had also promised to remedy the greatest crises facing the country through bold federal action, from climate change to racial injustice, and he had meant that, too. The period between January 6th and the passage of Biden's first major piece of legislation marked an early test of Biden's ability to juggle those goals and hold his party together as it began to govern. As united as Democrats were in the spirit of trying to get something done, there were still important gaps between what different wings of the party wanted to do and how they wanted to go about doing it. As overjoyed as Democrats remained about capturing the Senate majority, they learned quickly in February and March that controlling the Senate with 50 votes and a vice presidential tiebreaker was not quite a license to govern without obstruction. The last president had never bothered to learn the details of lawmaking. Trump did not study the details of the bills his own party crafted, and he had even less interest in holding good faith negotiations with his Democratic opponents or winning over outspoken Republican dissidents. Those traits sank some of his central legislative initiatives, most importantly, his effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Biden would take the oath with nearly half a century of legislative experience and a firm conviction that he could unite the unwieldy Democratic coalition. But he had never before negotiated a major deal from the Oval Office, and the balancing act ahead of him was one of elaborate complexity. Like Trump, Biden had rogue lawmakers in his own party, on the far left and in the stubborn center, and any small combination of them could become a major problem for his agenda, and his majorities were smaller than Trump's had ever been. In a conversation with his old friend Chris Dodd, the former Connecticut senator, before taking office, Biden said he was eager to get back into the thick of negotiations. Dodd warned him to proceed with caution. As president, Dodd said, Biden could not simply dive into high-stakes talks without having a reasonable expectation that they would work out. He could not routinely take political risks like that. "You could do it as Obama's vice president. You can't do it as president," Dodd recalls saying. "You don't want to go into the room not knowing the answer as president." Biden heard him out, but sounded undeterred. I'm good at it, he replied, according to Dodd. I mean, I do this. Dodd said that was true. You're better than all the people you're going to hire to do it. But he pressed Biden to focus on recruiting skilled deputies and then letting them do the dirty work of making offers and counteroffers with unpredictable lawmakers. Biden had done plenty of hiring already, and the people he had put in place at the highest levels of the White House largely aligned with Schumer and Pelosi and their view of congressional Republicans. Mostly veterans of the Obama administration, they were haunted by their party's last experience governing in an economic crisis in 2009, when a newly inaugurated Democratic president and his top staff had spent months pleading and horse trading for Republican support on various essential priorities and come away with little to show for it. Ron Klain was among the Biden aides who was clear-eyed about the early missteps of the Obama administration. An Indianapolis-raised son of a plumbing supply business owner, Klain had worked beside Biden on and off for decades. He was, in some respects, the platonic ideal of a Biden aide, with a middle-class Midwestern background that appealed to the Scranton-reared president and the elite credentials, degrees from Georgetown and Harvard, along with a Supreme Court clerkship that Biden prized in his closest aides. Not all Democrats shared Biden's admiration for Klain. Some party leaders grumbled about his hard-charging manner and expansive intellectual confidence. The Speaker of the House was one of those Democrats. Late in the 2020 campaign, Pelosi grew openly annoyed when an advisor urged her to consult with Klain about health care legislation. What, she asked, does Ron Klain know about anything? In Biden's reckoning, Klain knew quite a lot about quite a lot of things. The loyal aide had served as Biden's counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee and as his chief of staff in the vice presidency, and he had managed the Obama administration's response to the Ebola virus. Klain had left that administration with a view of its strengths and weaknesses that lined up closely with that of his longtime boss. The Obama administration, Klain believed, had moved too slowly in its early days to address the recession, and it had done too little to explain to the public what it was doing. A few days after the Capitol riot, with Washington still in a daze, Klain was already fixated on the puzzle of putting together a relief package and then selling it to the country. To a colleague who served with him in the Obama administration, Klain fretted that there was a risk Democrats would make the same mistakes again, allowing a drawn-out congressional negotiation over dollar figures and timetables to overshadow the real benefits the administration wanted to give voters. "Some of our friends have learned nothing from 2009," Klain said, according to this person. A mood of deep fear shrouded the nation's capital in the days before Joe Biden's inauguration. Even before January 6th, the event was shaping up as a somber and pared-back version of the traditionally grand ceremony. There would be social distancing and masking requirements in place, and rituals to mark the dreadful number of American fatalities would replace the black tie balls. The riot raised questions about whether even that version of the swearing-in could proceed. Washington already looked like an armed camp, with thousands of soldiers and guardsmen bearing heavy weaponry and black fencing installed around the Capitol. Even with those precautions, was it worth the security risk? A handful of Democrats, including Dianne Feinstein, the longtime California senator, thought it was not. But Biden would brook no talk of moving the event indoors. The world, he believed, had to see that the American system was stronger than Trump's lies and the violence of his supporters. His inauguration had to look like an inauguration. In the days before his swearing in, Biden already felt the awesome burden embodied in the event. It was a feeling Harry Truman described after ascending to the presidency, as if the moon, the stars, and all the planets had fallen on him. On January 18th, 2 days before he would take the oath, Biden told a friend, "The responsibility really hit me at dinner last night. I was around the table with the 5 grandkids. They're so brilliant, so conversant with the world," Biden said, according to this friend, "and I was thinking about what kind of world we're going to be leaving them, the kind of world they will be living in." Among members of Biden's party, however, there was more earthbound anxiety about moving ahead with the event. During a pair of conference calls the week after the riot, A series of Democrats spoke up to raise concerns with party leaders and with security officials about the inauguration. Lawmakers feared the possibility of an attack from protesters or from guests at the inauguration, or even from rogue members of the military, or their Republican colleagues. During a January 13th phone briefing with FBI and Secret Service officials, Marcy Kaptur of Ohio raised the possibility that the security forces themselves could be infiltrated by would-be terrorists or assassins. Could the security services guarantee, Kaptur asked, that there would not be Proud Boys or other domestic extremists among the National Guard forces called into Washington for the inauguration? The security officials on the call told Kaptur that those troops were screened by their units, but they stopped short of a definitive statement that infiltration was an impossibility. Abigail Spanberger, the former intelligence officer, raised another possible threat. Were people invited to attend the inauguration by members of Congress being subjected to security screenings? Spanberger herself had invited guests, and she said she had not been asked for any information about them. The Speaker of the House raised the most sensitive subject of all. Channeling her caucus's fear of their own Republican colleagues, Nancy Pelosi asked the Secret Service to commit to ensuring that every member of Congress would pass through a magnetometer to enter restricted areas on Capitol Hill. Pelosi did not name the Republicans she and other Democrats were worried about, but she did not have to. Every member of her caucus knew the names of the lawmakers who had whipped up the mob. They knew, too, that Republicans like Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene made a practice of showing off their love of firearms. The Secret Service punted the issue to the House Sergeant-at-Arms, to whom Pelosi gave the same edict. Every lawmaker had to be screened for guns and other weapons like any civilian in an airport. The Congress, Pelosi believed, could not afford to take a laxer approach. Nor could Joe Biden. On two calls the week before the inauguration, Peter DeFazio, the 73-year-old Oregon liberal who chaired the House Transportation Committee, spoke up with alarm about part of the president-elect's inaugural itinerary. Biden had long considered himself among the country's leading evangelists for rail travel, and he intended to journey from Delaware to his swearing-in on an Amtrak train. DeFazio said that plan had to be abandoned. It would be far too easy for a domestic terrorist to strike his train in a remote area, or even to attempt to halt it and board it. That view carried the day. Though Biden would not move his inauguration indoors, he would arrive at the Capitol by more discreet means than the Acela. On January 20th, the crowds lining Pennsylvania Avenue were considerably thinner than usual, and the audience for the new president's inaugural address was deliberately sparse. And as Biden stepped to the lectern to deliver his speech, two Capitol police officers stood guard behind him. It was not only the pandemic that President Biden had in mind when he said the country had just come through a crucible for the ages. Americans had learned anew, he said, that democracy is precious, democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed, Biden said. Biden again extended a rhetorical hand to his political opposition. It was time, he said, to end the country's uncivil war and work together as Americans. Arrayed on the platform around Biden was a bipartisan set of dignitaries who embodied the traditional political establishment, a group that included the woman who'd lost the presidency in 2016 to Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton had never hidden her anger about what happened in 2016, but in this moment she offered a gesture of conciliation, quietly reaching out to the man who had loaned Donald Trump a veneer of Christian respectability in his campaign against her 4 years earlier. Approaching Pence, Clinton offered the outgoing vice president an earnest thank you for his refusal to challenge the election results in the Senate. Pence, just as earnestly, expressed his appreciation for Clinton's overture. Donald Trump did not attend. The departed president, then bracing for his imminent impeachment trial, left the White House on the morning of Inauguration Day, decamping to his South Florida estate hours before Biden's swearing-in. His absence was neither surprising nor disappointing to the event organizers. Trump had announced 2 days after the Capitol attack, in his very last tweet before the social media site banned his account, that he would not join the ceremonies. His early escape made him the first president since Andrew Johnson, the failed and impeached successor to Abraham Lincoln, to skip his own successor's inauguration. There was no final effort by Trump to sabotage the transfer of power, nor was there an outbreak of violence at the inauguration. The 25,000 or so National Guard troops in Washington likely had something to do with it. On the morning of January 21st, Biden awoke in an optimistic mood. The country had been through a lot, and it was still suffering badly. A towering mountain of work lay ahead, but the transfer of power was finally complete. The United States, he believed, had shown the world that it was a resilient and free nation. In that hopeful spirit, Biden telephoned his old congressional colleague, Roy Blunt, the Missouri Republican, who had helped oversee the inauguration from his perch on the Senate Rules Committee. Blunt, who had just turned 71, also happened to be one of a few old-line Republicans left in the Senate who might, just might, be open to doing business with Biden. According to Blunt, Biden told him repeatedly after the inauguration, "The way you conducted the day made a big difference in how the whole day looked to the whole world." In foreign capitals, the inauguration was a reassuring ritual. In many of them, Trump's departure was more than welcome. But to some of America's most important allies, there were still alarming questions about the strength of American democracy and what Biden could do to restore it. Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, says he phoned friends in America, including former Clinton administration officials, to commiserate over that concern. It was already apparent in January, Blair says, that Trump's defeat had not cleansed America of its dangerous divisions. "You take as a given that the 6th of January was a terrible event," Blair says. "The question is, what does it say about what you need to do to bring the country back together?" It did not take long for President Biden and his party to remind Republicans that they were in charge of Washington. On his first day in office, Biden signed a suite of executive orders that tore central elements of the Trump legacy into shreds. He rejoined the Paris Climate Pact that Trump had repudiated and ended Trump's travel ban targeting mainly Muslim countries. He imposed masking and distancing requirements for federal employees that Trump had resisted and stopped construction of Trump's beloved border wall. He terminated the major pipeline project known as Keystone XL and halted new oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, among other measures. On the Hill, Pelosi and Schumer were both moving with dispatch to advance the legislation Biden's team had branded the American Rescue Plan, a $1.9 trillion aid bill that borrowed extensively from proposals House Democrats had passed the previous year, only to see them sputter in the Republican-controlled Senate. There was still some debate among leaders of the Democratic Party about the right path for steering that package into law. One view, held by Pelosi and Schumer, was that the party should bundle everything up in one bill and pass it through the reconciliation process, sparing themselves the burden of a long and potentially costly negotiation with Senate Republicans. Another view, entertained by Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader, and a cluster of moderates in the House and Senate, was that Democrats could take a two-track approach, split off the most popular measures and pass them quickly in a bipartisan bill, and then do the rest through reconciliation. Pelosi dismissed that approach out of hand, telling one advisor it was a dumb idea. Ron Klain was just as emphatic in private. Pelosi and Schumer did not want to take the two-track approach, he told associates, and so that was off the table. Besides, the legislation was popular as a full package. Why break it up? If moderates and Republicans wanted to vote for the most popular stuff, then they would also have to vote for the most expensive and progressive stuff, too. Schumer exposed his own strategy for the rescue bill in a phone call with a set of progressive groups and labor unions on January 24th. 4 days after the inauguration, as Biden was still weighing how to handle his diplomacy with the Senate, Schumer all but told these groups that he expected any efforts at bipartisanship to fail. The new president wanted to reach out to Republicans, Schumer acknowledged, and he believed Biden was doing that sincerely. But, Schumer said, the main objective was getting the relief bill into law by whatever means necessary. If that meant a party-line bill, then so be it. On COVID, as you know, Joe Biden's talking about bipartisan, Schumer said. But number one, like on everything we do, our number one goal is not the means to getting there, but getting there. We need a big, bold package. That sentiment was very much what Schumer's progressive audience wanted to hear. But the Democratic leader elaborated in ways that made clear he really meant it, naming several mainstream Republicans who had already criticized the cost of Biden's relief proposal and arguing that the path to compromise did not seem to exist. The chances of Biden's outreach working out, Schumer said, were not very good. The bottom line is, if they won't come along with us, we're not going to make the mistake, at least my judgment, and I am arguing strongly internally, is we should not make the mistake of 2008 and let them whittle it down. And then it took 10 years to recover, Schumer said, referring to the long slog back from the recession under the Obama administration. In an Oval Office meeting, two of Schumer's colleagues spelled out for Biden just how challenging his path through the Senate might be. In the House, the president and his team were confident that Pelosi could deliver the votes they needed to pass just about anything. The Senate was a different beast. Chris Coons and Tom Carper, the two senators from Delaware, met with Biden in the early days of his presidency and stressed that the president would have to walk a legislative tightrope to enact the draft legislation now known as the American Recovery Plan. Biden could pursue a bipartisan option by slimming down the bill and negotiating with Republicans, Coons told him. That would give him a chance of getting 60 votes for passage, avoiding reconciliation and overcoming a filibuster. But Coons, a second-term Democrat who believed deeply in the value of bipartisanship, did not downplay the problems with that approach. If Biden steered the rescue bill to the middle in pursuit of Republican votes, he would lose votes on the left. If that happened, then Democrats could find themselves having burned time on negotiations and bargained away key priorities, only to come up short of the votes needed to break a filibuster anyway. There was no guarantee that negotiating with Republicans could yield a deal at all. The Senate GOP was still in a scattered state, struggling to prepare for Trump's impeachment trial and to figure out how their own lives would work in the Senate minority. Republicans had given Biden mixed signals so far, and they had received mixed signals in return. A few, including Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, had indicated to the White House they were open to working together. In a November call, Collins told Klain she wanted to do business. But that was when Republicans expected to have a strong hand in negotiations because they believed they would be in the Senate majority. Now, Democrats had the 50 senators plus Kamala Harris budget reconciliation option at their disposal, and they seemed inclined to use it, so long as they could get their more conservative members to go along with the plan. Still, Republicans knew the Democrats' margin of control was precarious, so precarious that Biden and his party might be willing to offer handsome rewards for even modest cooperation. A few Republicans had already engaged in political horse trading in order to extract goodies from the Biden administration. Murkowski and her fellow Alaskan Dan Sullivan had been enraged by Biden's moratorium on new drilling leases, but not so enraged that they would not make a deal with Biden to back his progressive nominee for Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. Both voted to confirm the New Mexico congresswoman to the important job governing public lands in exchange for Biden replacing his existing nominee for the department's number two job with a more business-friendly pick. There had been a number of robust bipartisan votes for other Biden nominees, including all four of the cabinet's most prominent offices, State, Treasury, Justice, and Defense. Mitch McConnell himself had voted in favor of all four of Biden's nominees for those jobs. For administration officials inclined to seek out compromise, there were at least a few encouraging signs so far. At the very least, there was no full-on blockade attempt from the Republican side. But Biden and his advisors were not naive about the less hospitable currents within the Senate Republican Conference. Schumer's observation about the harsh criticism of Biden's plan, even from traditional Republicans, was spot on, and the White House knew it. And Biden himself had absorbed more personal reasons for distrusting the GOP. For all Biden's insistence that he did not hold grudges, he was keenly sensitive to which Republicans had and had not acknowledged the legitimacy of the 2020 election. It rankled him when he had to deal with senior Republicans like Kevin McCarthy, who had echoed Trump's most egregious lies about the vote that made Biden president. The Senate had more than a few of those. Biden had seen, too, how the Trump years had exposed the most opportunistic impulses of people he used to respect. No one loomed larger in that category than Lindsey Graham, who had gone from being Biden's personal friend to joining Trump's attacks on Biden's troubled son, Hunter. Graham had called up Biden after the election to try to patch things up and offered the president-elect some advice. Biden, Graham said, should reach out to Trump and invite him to play golf as a way of lowering the political temperature. It was an off-key suggestion. Biden was not interested in following Graham's footsteps onto the fairway with Trump. The First Lady, Jill Biden, had told people during the campaign that Graham had crossed a line, and as much as the often malleable Graham was a potentially promising negotiating partner for his administration, Biden saw the South Carolina senator's decision to join forces with Trump against their family as a profound betrayal. But White House aides knew that they had to make some form of an overture to the GOP. There were Republican senators who wanted to have that conversation, and Biden wanted to have it with them. There were also a few Senate Democrats who felt strongly that it was important at least to give bipartisanship a try. After all, Republicans might no longer be in the Senate majority, but having a constructive relationship with a handful of them could make a big difference down the line, especially if Biden really was serious about wanting to show the country and the world that the two parties could work together. What the White House did not know was that Susan Collins and a handful of other Republicans had not yet given up on reclaiming the Senate majority by attempting to flip a friendly Democrat. Even as they engaged in tentative talks with the new president about a possible legislative compromise, Senate Republicans were on a covert mission to win back control of the chamber they had lost at the ballot box, and their focus was on Joe Manchin. And for a brief moment, it seemed that Vice President Harris might have given Republicans an unexpected opening. Kamala Harris did not say anything particularly surprising in her January 28th interview with WSAZ, the NBC affiliate in Huntington, West Virginia. The country, she said, was confronting a crisis of unbelievable proportion and needed politicians to step up and stand up for them. She did not mention Joe Manchin, the state's senior senator, by name. But Manchin, the Senate's most conservative Democrat, knew political pressure when he saw it. Harris had done only two local television interviews on that day in late January. The other one had been with a station in Arizona, the home state of another centrist Democratic senator, Kyrsten Sinema, who needed some nudging to back Biden's plans. It was not exactly brutal arm-twisting by a domineering White House, but Manchin did not appreciate it, and he made his displeasure known publicly. "I couldn't believe it," he said, complaining that no one in the White House had given him a heads-up on the interview. In a brushback to Harris's implicit pitch for a fast-moving reconciliation bill, Manchin stressed, "We're going to try to find a bipartisan pathway forward." That weekend, a plan took shape among Senate Republicans. Susan Collins initiated it. She shared a warm relationship with Manchin, and the West Virginia Democrat had crossed party lines to endorse her reelection in 2020. Collins knew Manchin well enough to understand that his identity as a Democrat meant something to him, as a 73-year-old Italian Catholic who came up revering the Kennedys. The view of Manchin, ubiquitous among progressives, that he was practically a Republican in sheep's clothing, overlooked the depth of his relationship with the Democratic Party. He had been approached multiple times by Republicans about switching parties. Trump had even dangled a cabinet job in front of him, and Manchin had rebuffed them every time. The conservative Democrat had voted over and over to defend his party's core priorities, like the Affordable Care Act and opposing tax cuts for the wealthy, and he enjoyed close relationships with state and national labor leaders, including the powerful teachers' union president, Randy Weingarten. Manchin had a habit of calling the famed political consultant James Carville to complain that the left did not appreciate that he was a real damn Democrat. Susan Collins understood this about her friend. But Collins also knew Manchin liked working with Republicans and cared about getting along with them. He had already doomed Biden's nominee to lead the Office of Management and Budget, Neera Tanden, because he was upset about her history of nasty tweets about his Republican colleagues. Besides, if Manchin wanted to run for another Senate term in 2024, it would be far easier as a Republican. Collins called up John Thune, the number two Senate Republican. She wanted his help making the case for Manchin to defect.
On Monday evening, February 1st, they took Manchin to dinner in an upstairs room at Bistro Cacao, a French restaurant on Capitol Hill. Thune, Collins, and a third Republican, Rob Portman of Ohio, plied Manchin with entreaties to leave his party. Manchin had rejected appeals to become a Republican in the past, so Thune pitched him on a middle option, one that would not involve formally embracing the GOP label. "You don't have to join our caucus," Thune told him. "Just become an independent and caucus with us." Thune suggested Manchin would likely be rewarded for taking such a step. "You could write your own ticket," the South Dakotan told him. "Chair a committee. We'll help you raise money for your campaign." Manchin heard them out and gave Thune a politically deft response. "John," he said, "if you were the leader, I would do it." It was not exactly a hard no, but Manchin was not about to put Mitch McConnell back in charge of the Senate. The West Virginian conveyed something else to his Republican colleagues. Biden had quickly shown real contrition about his White House's misstep in deploying Harris that way. Before the Republicans could get to Manchin, Biden had already hosted him in the Oval Office to patch things up. In Manchin's telling over dinner, Biden had been solicitous. Biden had welcomed Manchin into the Oval for a joint meeting with him and the vice president, a gesture the White House intended to convey that Biden and Harris were a steadfast political team. But at one point, when Biden had wanted to talk candidly with Manchin about his views on the rescue bill, the president had asked everyone else to leave the room, including Harris. In Manchin's recounting to those three Republicans, Biden had told him, "Joe, you're my friend. I'll never ask you to vote against your conscience. I'll never ask you to do anything you are uncomfortable doing." Manchin believed him. He was not going to become a Republican. What it would take to get Manchin's vote on a rescue bill was still an open question. While the daily chaos of the Trump era was receding, Manchin's private meetings on that first day of February suggested that the equilibrium of Joe Biden's Washington was delicate indeed.
By the time Manchin sat down to dinner that evening, the bipartisan approach he favored seemed to be disintegrating. Also that day, Biden hosted a meeting with 10 Republican senators, including Collins, Portman, Murkowski, and Mitt Romney, who said they were open to striking a deal on a rescue bill. But the group brought Biden something else unpleasant, a proposed framework for bipartisan legislation that envisioned a much, much smaller relief bill from the one Biden had put together. Biden had asked Congress for $1.9 trillion in spending. The Republicans wanted the price tag to come down by about two-thirds, they told the White House. The two sides did not move much closer in the meeting with Biden. Republicans were willing to fund the basics of vaccine distribution, smaller stimulus checks aimed only at lower-income Americans, and less than a sixth of the school safety funding in Biden's plan. They offered no aid to state and local government. It was a spare offer that made it easy for Biden to say no. Biden did no scolding or lecturing in the meeting, and neither did his guests. It was a respectful back and forth, but there was no easy path to a middle ground. At one point, the president echoed his tutorial from Coons, explaining almost apologetically that if he cut down the size of his legislation to placate Republicans, he would lose votes from his own party. Both Biden and his advisors shared a skepticism about the basic political seriousness of the offer Republicans put on the table. Steve Ricchetti, one of Biden's most important emissaries to the GOP, said to one lawmaker before the meeting that they needed to know there was enough potential Republican support for a compromise before entering serious negotiations. "Until they've got 10 signatures on a piece of paper, we've got nothing to talk about," he said, according to this person. The meeting was not encouraging on that front. The White House told Senate Democrats after the meeting that it was not clear that all 10 of the Republicans who met with Biden could be counted on to vote for a bill even in the $600 billion range they proposed. If Republicans were not offering a guaranteed win for a smaller package, what was the point of even attempting to go small? The White House released a statement shortly after the meeting that all but rejected the Republican offer. The president also made clear that the American Rescue Plan was carefully designed to meet the stakes of this moment,
and any changes in it cannot leave the nation short of its pressing needs, said the statement attributed to Jen Psaki, the press secretary. The same week, Biden addressed a video call of House Democrats and did not sound like a president preparing to slash more than $1 trillion out of his draft legislation. He told them his economic advisers, including Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, had warned against doing just that. The mistake would be going too small rather than going too big, Biden said. His chief of staff was even blunter in his rejection of calls to trim things down. When Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, wrote critically about Biden's plan, warning that it could spur inflation, Klain privately dismissed Summers by pointing to his role shaping the deficient Obama stimulus. People should ask Summers, Klain sniped, how far he got on economic recovery legislation or anything else after the first stimulus was a bust. The Biden-Klain view was already the prevailing attitude in Nancy Pelosi's house. On February 1st, the Speaker and Schumer filed a joint budget resolution to start the process of turning Biden's $1.9 trillion rescue package into law. The legislative body language was not difficult for Republicans to interpret. They were welcome to have their talks with the White House, but the Democratic Congress was moving forward with or without them. While some of the most intense trauma of January 6th had begun to subside, many Democrats could not forget how the most extreme members of the Republican conference had behaved, and how so many others who considered themselves mainstream had gone along with an unconscionable plan to oppose certification of the election results. Val Demings found after January 6th that she could not bring herself even to say hello to Republican lawmakers she had once considered her friends. She and the other House Democrats who had been trapped in the gallery were still in close touch, forming a text chain they called the Gallery Group to keep an open line in the aftermath of that searing experience. Within her congressional office, Demings responded to the attack with a stern instruction. When a Republican comes to us with a proposal they want me to endorse, she told her aides, check to see if they voted to overturn the election. If they did, Demings felt it was going to be much tougher to work together. Anna Eshoo, the senior California lawmaker close to Pelosi, had a painful conversation with her daughter about the experience of interacting with Republicans after the riot. To the 78-year-old Californian, after a quarter century in Congress, the physical space of the Capitol felt defiled. There was a pervasive sense of violation, she says. I think it's with all of us, that they were there, what they did, what they said, how they desecrated the place, and how close we came to the government being overthrown. When her daughter asked how it felt to go to work with Republicans who were still denying the election results, Eshoo offered one of the most wrenching comparisons imaginable. It feels like being in the same room with your rapist, she recalls saying. The House majority took action in early February against one of the Republicans most deeply implicated in Trump's attack on the election. Marjorie Taylor Greene had long since been exposed as an extreme conspiracy theorist, and more recently years-old videos had surfaced of her hounding David Hogg, the Parkland school shooting survivor, and promoting threats against Pelosi. During her congressional race in 2020, Greene had posted a photo of herself holding a gun beside an image of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and two of the other progressive women of color, sometimes known as the Squad. If there was one Republican who had shown she had no business serving in Congress, Democrats believed it was her. Pelosi thought it would be pointless to try expelling Greene from the House. Even if an expulsion vote succeeded, the Speaker believed Greene would easily win a special election in her district and return to Congress in a matter of months. But Pelosi and other Democratic leaders agreed Greene could not be allowed to serve on policymaking committees. A person who harassed student gun control activists had no place on the Education Committee, of which Greene was a member. Kevin McCarthy, once again trying to avoid a hard choice, asked Steny Hoyer if they could cut a deal on Greene. Republicans would strip her of her spot on the Education Committee, but leave her on the Budget Committee. Hoyer rejected the offer. Democrats were going to punish Greene in a floor vote, and Republicans could be with them or against them. A gentlemanly moderate who hailed from a more collegial era and sought out relationships with Republicans, Hoyer was in some respects an unlikely contender to lead the charge against Greene. But the majority leader, then 81, was no factional leader of centrist Democrats. Having spent nearly two decades as Pelosi's deputy and on-and-off rival, Hoyer was keenly sensitive to the diverse currents of the Democratic caucus, and he understood how much the liberal women targeted by Green needed to feel the support of their party. In a small leadership meeting before the February 4th debate on Green, Hoyer told Pelosi he needed 15 minutes to make remarks on the floor. Pelosi was skeptical. "Steny," she asked, "who wants to hear from you for 15 minutes?" On the floor, Hoyer brandished the image Green had posted the previous year demonizing three progressive women of color. Challenging Republicans to look at her extremism and incitement for what it was, Hoyer pleaded with them to stand up for the decency of the House. Ocasio-Cortez and her allies, he said, deserved a basic human respect that Green had refused to give them. "They're not the squad," he said, his voice rising. "They're Ilhan. They're Alexandria. They're Rashida. They are people. They are our colleagues." Ilhan Omar, the progressive Minnesota lawmaker whose face appeared in Green's ad, was sitting directly behind Hoyer as he spoke. As he mimicked holding up an AR-15, the Democrat who'd left Somalia as a refugee said just loud enough to be picked up by the microphone, "Sounds like the guns I fled." Hoyer's ferocious defense of the House and his liberal colleagues stirred Democrats, and the party voted unanimously to strip Green of her committee assignments. But only 11 Republicans joined them in meting out the Democrats' chosen penalty, just one more than voted to impeach Trump for inciting the attack on the Capitol. Trump's party was not ready to punish or purge the extremists in their ranks, and certainly not at a time and in a fashion of Nancy Pelosi's choosing. Remarkably, the poisonous atmosphere in the House did not generate an especially bitter front of Republican resistance to the American Rescue Plan. As the Democrats moved the multi-trillion-dollar piece of legislation through committees, House Republicans were not making much of an argument against it. Trump's free-spending ways and his December endorsement of distributing $2,000 checks had clouded the party's approach to pandemic relief and fiscal policy generally. Republicans were also too tangled in their own civil war and a still ongoing impeachment trial to focus on the mammoth rescue package rolling through the chamber. 2 days after Pelosi introduced the budget resolution with Schumer, the House GOP was debating whether to keep Liz Cheney in her leadership role. Not that Republicans in the House could have stopped the American Rescue Plan, even if they had been better organized and more attentive. Unlike the Senate, the House offered no powerful legislative tools to the minority. To have any influence at all, they had to use their political megaphone to raise a cry of outrage from the voters. But voters seemed to be on the Democrats' side, at least where pandemic relief was concerned. They liked what they knew about the basics of the bill, the huge sums of money for economic aid and public health, and Republicans were not really trying to change their minds. As the House Ways and Means Committee began assembling the bill in committee meetings during the second week of February, Richie Neal, the chairman, called up Pelosi one evening with an astounded observation. "Madam Speaker, there was no acrimony," Neal told her, according to his memory. Pelosi was confused. "What do you mean?" she asked. "They made some proposals," Neal said of the Republicans, "but they didn't challenge us on facts and need." After fighting like mad to block the certification of a fair election, House Republicans were largely taking a pass on a debate over $1.9 trillion in relief spending that included a new social welfare benefit in the greatly expanded child tax credit. The Republicans' passivity was a welcome gift for Democrats, in a way, but it also showed the degree to which Republicans were animated by Trumpian grievance and lacked a core set of guiding principles on policy. The Republicans' passivity had only done so much to help the Democrats, who were wrestling with their own divisions. They had a bill to pass, and once Trump's impeachment trial concluded on February 13th, Democratic impatience to pass the rescue plan began spiking. Biden had been in office nearly a month, and the House was moving quickly toward passing a sweeping bill, but the Senate was still more of a question mark. Bipartisan talks had not ended, and Joe Manchin had still not quite indicated what he would and would not vote for. In a virtual meeting on February 17th, House Democrats began to flash annoyance with the legislative process and angst about the looming review of the rescue bill by the Senate parliamentarian. Some were especially focused on the minimum wage hike. The measure was a huge priority for the party as a whole and for labor unions in particular. But it was uncertain whether raising the federal requirement to $15 per hour would survive either the Senate parliamentarian or the centrist flank of the Senate Democratic Caucus. During the House video call, Bobby Scott, the chairman of the Education and Labor Committee, warned his colleagues that the fate of the minimum wage was very much in doubt in the Senate and said Democrats could not afford to back down easily. "Activists are ready to go to bat and fight for this, and House Democrats cannot give up on this issue," Scott said, according to one account of the meeting. "We promised we would include it, and we must deliver." Pelosi, trying to keep spirits high, closed the call by reciting a quote from Tennyson. "For I dipped into the future, far as human eye could see, saw the vision of the world and all the wonder that would be, and insisting to her caucus that a wondrous victory was at hand." But in private, the speaker was also starting to tire of the ambiguity on the Senate side. While Pelosi would never say so to a group of hundreds of House Democrats, she was puzzled by Biden's deference toward Manchin and the White House's seeming eagerness to cater to a tiny number of moderates in the Senate who did not yet seem to know precisely what their red lines were. One friend who spoke with Pelosi during this time says she expressed genuine confusion about the White House's handling of Manchin. In her own chamber, the speaker had not made a habit of letting one recalcitrant lawmaker hold up her plans. Pelosi was drawing plenty of red lines on her own, conveying to the White House and Schumer that if Manchin or anyone else tried to shave down the state and local aid in the bill, then there would be hell to pay. She delivered the same message to Schumer on the generous tax credits included in the House legislation. If the Senate tried to limit the refundability of those benefits, restricting how many lower-income Americans could access them, she would consider it totally unacceptable. Pelosi and Schumer had a trusting but not close relationship. One Pelosi advisor acknowledged that the speaker felt she had to keep the senator close because if she didn't, then he'd veer into his own waters, as the advisor put it. The two leaders had to be in constant touch, this person said, for Pelosi to feel confident that they'd stay in political lockstep. Schumer promised Pelosi his chamber would observe her red lines. The White House was getting impatient, too. Biden and his aides had continued to stroke the most moderate members of the Senate Democratic Caucus, and they had developed a sharper sense of how the legislation would need to change to get nearly 50 votes. Centrists in both the House and Senate did not like the idea of giving $1,400 stimulus checks even to wealthy people, and so the White House agreed to phase out eligibility for Americans making more than $75,000 per year. Still, they were not quite at 50 votes, and Manchin was not the only one frustrating the president and his team. Biden confessed in private that he did not really understand Sinema, the aloof Arizona Democrat known on the Hill for her cryptic policy views and flamboyant attire. In December, she had attended the swearing-in of her state's junior senator, Mark Kelly, in a purple wig and tiger print coat. More recently, Sinema had joined Manchin in voicing a preference for bipartisanship and resistance to a $15 minimum wage. One person close to the president likened Biden's perplexity at Sinema to his difficulty grasping his grandchildren's use of the viral video app TikTok. He wanted to relate, but he just didn't quite get it. Manchin was vexing to the White House for less generational reasons. The conservative Democrat hailed from a state with a long history of amassing congressional seniority and then extracting huge federal subsidies for parochial interests. But Manchin did not seem interested in claiming the crown from Robert C. Byrd, his venerable predecessor in the Senate, as the king of pork. In fact, he told the White House he was concerned about the generous cash payments in the House bill because of the effect they might have on voters back home. "Too many people in West Virginia," Manchin said, "would just use that free money to buy drugs." Negotiation in the Senate simply was not the same beast it had been during Biden's heyday as a senator in the late 20th century, or even during his two terms as vice president. A president could not often count on being able to sway wavering senators by directing money to their states, Nor could he have any consistent expectation that the opposition party would give some deference to a new administration elected by a wide popular majority. Biden was within striking distance of a major legislative victory, but he was not there yet. And his second goal, of showing the country that the two parties could get things done together, seemed exceedingly remote. On February 20th, Biden spent an afternoon with someone who understood just how much things had changed since the Senate of the last century. Taking a short ride from the White House to the Watergate apartment complex, the new president paid a visit to Bob Dole, the former Republican Senate Majority Leader who had recently been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. The two men had served together for 23 years. Both had run for president in 1988, during the last election before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Dole was a proud Republican to the core, and he had supported Trump even in moments when other party elders declined to do so. But he had been deeply troubled by Trump's refusal to concede defeat in the 2020 election, and even more so by the January 6th riot. The people who stormed the Capitol that day, he said in an interview for this book, were not patriots, they were troublemakers. By February, Dole, then 97, was ailing badly, and the visit from Biden meant something to the old World War II hero. The visit, Dole said afterward, was mostly happy talk. It wasn't Mr. President, it was Joe and Bob, Dole said. We were back in the Senate, and we talked about the good old days. You know, that was a good time in our lives, in both our lives, Dole reflected, when we seemed to work together and worked across the aisle and generally got things done. In Dole's reckoning, that wasn't possible anymore for a pretty simple reason. Trust, he said. They don't trust each other. 1 week later, on February 27th, the House passed the American Rescue Plan on a nearly party-line vote. Pelosi lost only two Democrats on the roll call, Kurt Schrader of Oregon and Jared Golden of Maine, both among the most conservative members of her caucus. Every Republican voted against the bill. Speeding the bill toward passage in the Senate was a ruling from the Senate parliamentarian, Elizabeth McDonough, on the eve of the House vote. The minimum wage did not belong in a reconciliation bill, she decided. It was a tough setback for progressives and unions, but on a tactical level, it was something of a gift to Biden because the biggest sticking point for Manchin and Sinema was gone. Even if all 50 Democratic senators had wanted a $15 minimum wage, passing it in the rescue bill was not an option. Far fewer than 50 Democratic senators did not want to vote for a $15 minimum wage. In a largely symbolic vote on March 5th, just 42 members of the caucus voted in favor of the measure. Both Manchin and Sinema voted against it, and Sinema drew progressive rage online by communicating her vote with a theatrical thumbs-down gesture. But the tally of no votes included half a dozen others, including Coons and Carper, John Tester, and Jean Shaheen, confirming that the avowedly moderate faction in Biden's party was more than just one or two habitual renegades. But Manchin went out of his way one more time to earn his reputation as the chief Democratic stumbling block to Biden's agenda, insisting on one more last-minute concession on the day of the Senate vote. Some of his Republican friends, including Rob Portman, had been lobbying him to insist on phasing out the federal government's program of enhanced unemployment benefits as soon as July. That was a non-starter for Manchin's party, but the West Virginian stalled a vote for hours as he negotiated a more modest paring back of those benefits. It was an exasperating final stretch for the White House and Senate Democrats, and in the heat of the back and forth with Manchin, one of Biden's closest advisors wrote in a text message that the senator seemed more focused on the symbolism of supporting Republican-backed changes to the bill than on any matters of substance. What he really wants is to vote for Republican amendments, this advisor wrote, because they are Republican. It was a shrewd read. For Manchin, bipartisanship itself was the objective, more than the underlying issue. It was a lesson Democrats would learn again and again for the rest of the year. But the final concessions to Manchin yielded a breakthrough. A party-line vote in the Senate to push a $1.9 trillion rescue plan into law. With 50 votes in the Senate, Democrats secured federal spending that saved state and local governments from fiscal disaster. poured money into vaccination efforts, school safety, and aid to businesses, and forged a fully refundable tax credit that would give up to $300 per month to parents of young children. The last of those was an expensive short-term benefit, but one that Democrats said they fully intended to make permanent as a decisive blow against child poverty. At a Rose Garden ceremony with Pelosi and Schumer on March 12th, the proud new president said he had promised the American people that help was on the way, and now Democrats had made good on that promise. Detailing the expansive benefits of the legislation, Biden lavished praise on both the congressional leaders. Klain had nudged Biden immediately after the bill was passed to make sure he praised Schumer. The Senate process had been messy, but it had ended with an enormous win for a majority leader who is still proving himself. "I owe you, Chuck," Biden said. "You did an incredible job." But the president had a larger message. "We are showing it's possible to get big, important things done," Biden said, adding, "It's critical to demonstrate that government can function and deliver prosperity, security, and opportunity for the people in this country." The legislation was encouraging for the new administration on several levels. It guaranteed that they would not, like the Obama administration in 2009, wind up regretting that they went too small on economic relief. The American Rescue Plan ensured that Biden's first year was not dominated by mass layoffs in municipal school systems and police departments, or by mass grievance that a new Democratic government was providing far less generous government aid than Donald Trump's administration. And it showed that, under certain dire circumstances, Biden's complicated party could close ranks around an immense work of government policy and ram it into law without a single Republican vote. There were more bracing takeaways from the legislative process, too. There was no sign that Biden had made meaningful headway in working with Republicans, and Manchin and Sinema had made it clear enough that they could not be counted on to drive a sweeping liberal agenda into law. Even in victory, some progressives were fuming at their defeat on the minimum wage and frustrated at the extent to which Senate centrists had dominated the final negotiations. In other words, if the American Rescue Plan was a political triumph, it was not certain that it provided Biden and his party with a blueprint for enacting the rest of their agenda. But in the Rose Garden that day, thoughts were not yet fixed on the heavy lifting ahead. In an interview that week, Schumer was elated. Congressional Democrats held their own celebration on the Capitol's West Front, ahead of the White House ceremony, on an early spring day that matched their bright mood. Striding back inside, Schumer said the new law was one of the most important things we've done in decades. Schumer's Republican counterpart sensed a potential sea change, too. Talking to a friend a few weeks after Biden signed the rescue bill into law, McConnell confided that he was deeply concerned that the Democratic legislation could have such far-reaching effects on the country that would make it hard for Republicans to undo benefits like the child tax credit, even if they retook Congress in 2022. If Americans grew used to the benefits in the new law, he suggested, it would become politically untenable for Republicans to repeal its most popular measures. The country, McConnell lamented, might cross a point of no return toward becoming a European-style social welfare state, exactly the outcome he had spent his career arguing against. And the Democrats were far from finished with their legislative agenda. The success of the American Rescue Plan only reinforced President Biden's inclination to go big, to reach for a Rooseveltian place in American domestic policy, and to shed the incremental policy promises of his primary campaign in favor of a far more daring governing vision. He had still not abandoned his desire to work with Republicans, but if two great strains of ambition had been competing within Biden, his desire to foster national reconciliation and his aspiration to craft a presidency of grand and lasting impact, there was little doubt which was stronger as springtime approached. In early March, he hosted a gathering at the White House with a group of historians, including the prominent biographers Doris Kearns Goodwin and Walter Isaacson, the Princeton historian Eddie Glaude Jr., and the Harvard historian Annette Gordon Reed. The session stretched for 3 hours as Biden posed question after question to the group and soaked up the lessons of past presidential greatness. Biden told the historians he wanted to turn America into a country where working people would know, "We have your back." Claude supplied him with another description for that agenda. What Biden was talking about, he said, was creating a broad infrastructure of social care, according to one attendee. Biden wanted to be known as a great champion of science, he said, and Isaacson offered him Dwight Eisenhower as a model to follow. Biden grilled Goodwin, who was seated directly across from him, about how Franklin Roosevelt governed. The president wanted to know, should he do fireside chats, as Roosevelt did? Should he find some more modern version of a direct conversation with the American people? According to one person in the room, the president kept returning to one central question. How big can we go? Biden asked them. As Biden contemplated the great presidents of the past, one more recent occupant of his office was following the new administration's success with a mixture of respect and, well, some more complicated feelings. Barack Obama had taken note of the way that Biden aides and even congressional Democrats like Schumer were criticizing his first year in office and his early handling of the Great Recession. The former president felt they were unfairly disparaging his record. Obama did not think he and his team had been played for fools by Republican senators, nor did he think the stimulus law he negotiated was such an obvious failure. "You know," he told one former administration official, "it was a different world in 2009. The Democratic Party was different back then, with far more conservatives in the Senate than people remember. The country was different, too." Some veterans of Obama's administration went much further in private than their old boss ever did, griping about how Biden had no business positioning himself as a bolder, braver president, when back in the day he had been one of their administration's biggest proponents of bipartisanship and political caution. Obama and Biden spoke by phone occasionally, but not often. Their conversations were friendly and supportive, but hardly the stuff of the tight brotherhood both men had sold to the country as a cheery political fable. A few people close to both men detected a certain tension, at least on one side of the relationship. Nancy Pelosi, who spoke regularly with the former president, came away from her conversations with Obama during this period with a matter-of-fact diagnosis. She told a friend, "Obama is jealous of Biden." There was another prominent Democrat who shared that assessment, Joe Biden himself. Having finally shed his dutiful supporting role in the Obama show, the 46th president echoed Pelosi's view in a conversation with an advisor several months into his tenure. His days of being looked down upon by the smart set in someone else's West Wing were over, and Biden knew it. "I'm confident that Barack is not happy with the coverage of this administration as more transformative than his," Biden said, according to this advisor.